If you start with actually, you should probably start with saying, since I'm supposed to talk about what towards what exponential Wilkie inequality, you should probably start with saying what is a Wilkie inequality. One way to think about Wilkie inequality is if you have a field, you have small elements and big elements. And the Wilkie inequality is saying that if you take an extension of this field, so you normally have a field with zero. Here you have small elements, here you have big elements, some suitable definition of this. And the Wilkie inequality says that in the extension, essentially you're either adding a small element or a big element. What we have to do is there's some equivalence classes involved, but seeing what exactly small was big. So the Wilkie inequality is basically saying you add something adding one of these smaller things or one of the bigger things. Now, the version I was working on, we have this. Okay. Small elements. Considering small, or elements that are bounded by something that's definable without parameters. And the equivalence class we're talking about, for every small element, there's, I never know how to write this right, but we can say it's the inner, if we take, call it the monad of X, is an intersection of open intervals. In some sense, it's an intersection of open intervals where C1 and C2 are definable from X. And of course, C1 less than X less than C2. If you get X in it. It gives you an open set around the X, and that's where we're going to consider the residue of X. The proper definition of the residue field is you take the field and you modulo out by maximal ideal. You take a subfield and modulo out by the maximal ideal. More general way to define this for if you don't have a field structure, something like this, where you take an intersection of a bunch of these intervals. There's some other details we don't need to worry about, but dealing with finite elements, that would be what you consider small. The big things we call T-levels. The T-level of an element is you take every zero definable function that goes off to infinity and take the image of X under all these things. So if X starts out being infinite, you get a convex set containing infinite elements. And this is an equivalence class for everything. If something's in the T level of X, then X is in the T level of that. Okay. These are the two things I deal with. We have a very general Wilkie inequality that deals with these elements. This is not a great ideal one. The Wilkie inequality for the power-bounded set, for the power-bounded setting, the big elements would be essentially valuations, which are much smaller than these T-levels. And this should be refinable, but this is something that works in all cases. There's a Wilkie inequality for this that doesn't depend upon any group structure, any field structure. You can throw in any functions you want, it'll work for this. To give some examples, we can talk about, just notation, for any function you use a subscript to denote how many times you compose it with itself. A negative number would mean a compositional inverse. So, what are these T levels? If you take the real field, throw in the exponential function, the T level becomes a union of take intervals from iterates of log of x to the iterates of exponential of x. This could also be called the exponential comparability class of x. Other settings, like in this, if you don't have the exponential function, just have a field, it becomes a union over n of nth roots to x. Whoops, I have a paper there. You ever put up here? Make it a little bit smaller so it fits here. X1 over n. Because it's union of intervals, we take nth roots and nth powers. It's in general, if you have some cofinal set of functions, of definable functions, you can take the union of the image of x under those functions and the image of x under the inverse of those functions. Okay. So the nice. Where was this one? We'll get to that. This general form of the Wilk inequality, which we'll hope to refine to actually something more specific that gives more information, says that if you take any O minimal model and you extend it by some element, well, you have some extension, you have some extension model, you throw in one of the elements from the extension and you take the definable closure of that. You can either add a new one of these classes or you can add a T-level, but not both. It's a basic idea. So the question is, what can we do with this sort of thing? This is rather rough. To actually get most of the results from the power bounded case to exponential case, we need something more specific than this. But this has some applications in looking at D-minimal structures. Okay, so what's a D-minimal structure? Well, we can compare D-minimality to O-minimality. There's an O-minimality criteria, which says that if you have the underlying set of a model is definably connected, and every unary definable set without interior is a finite union of singletons. It's not the usual definition of O-minimality, but it's equivalent. Say D-minimality, we extend this by saying this definable sets without interior is a finite union of discrete sets. Now, when talk about an O-minimal structure, we mean any structure which satisfies the O-minimality criteria. For D-minimality, we're actually going to say a structure is D-minimal if every elementarily equivalent model, every elementarily equivalent structure, theory of the structure, any model of that theory, it satisfies the D-minimality criteria. Essentially, it's like a strong minimality, where every model of theory has to have this property. Nice thing about O-minimality is that once you know that one model is O-minimal, all the models are. Is it true for D-minimality? Not sure. The history of O-minimality, one of the first papers on O-minimality realized that in order to get good results, you had to assume that every model of your theory was O-minimal. So we'll just assume every model of the theory is D-minimal. It just happened later on, Play, Knight, and Steinhorn showed that if one model is O-minimal, then every model is. Okay, so here's some examples. O-minimal structures are D-minimal. A singleton is a discrete set. So if you start with the real field is O-minimal. And to get the way we're looking to get the minimal structures is we add a discrete set to the structure. And we know some things. We know that if we add the natural numbers, it's not d-minimal. Because from the natural numbers, you can define the rational numbers. And the rational numbers is not a finite union of discrete sets. But if you add a faster-growing sequence, like 2 to the n, then the resulting structure is d-minimal. But it's not just the growth rate, because if you change this set slightly and multiply the 2 to the 2 to the n by n, you get something that's not d-minimal. So, or just 2 to the n is d-minimal. I picked these two because these fit in nicely with the test coming up. But in some sense, it has to grow fast. Something as small as n that grows as fast as n doesn't work that well. Doesn't work. But it's not just growing fast. There's a result that if something grows really, really fast, then it's d-minimal. In this intermediate stage, there's a question of which sets actually give you d-minimal structures and which don't. The next criteria we're going to come up with is nice feature about this set, this 2 to the 2 to the n, is that you can get from one element to the next element by squaring it. There's a definable function which takes you from one element of this set to the next one. There's a test for figuring out when things are d-minimal, and in this test, this Wilkie inequality comes into play. So the setting for this is, to make things a little simpler, we let R be an O-minimal expansion of a group. And actually, to make everything work, every model that you care about is probably going to be a group anyway, but really just need definable Skolem functions. Okay, and you take E to be a set, which is essentially a discrete set, but instead of saying it's discrete, we're going to make a few more requirements to get a nice setup. It's going to have it's going to have an infinum, and the infinum is going to be in E. It's going to contain its smallest element. We'll call that M. Just for convenience, we'll make it bigger than 0. In this case, 0 is just some element smaller than M. Since we already named 0, we'll keep it so simple. It makes it simple that way. In terms of discreteness, for every element in your structure, every element in R, you can find the predecessor in E and the successor in E. There's a greatest element in E that's less than your element, and the least element in E that's bigger than the element. In case you're actually in E, we'll make E, the successor is the equal part. The predecessor. And we can incorporate this into functions. You find the two functions that take you, sigma takes you to the successor, lambda takes you to the predecessor. And there's this. And be complete, this is the default values for these things. If you're smaller than M, there's no predecessor, successor, so just set the predecessor to 0 and the successor to M. In some sense, minus infinity would be a nice symbol to have in this case, instead of 0. Okay, so in the test, the test for showing things are minimal is a quantifier elimination result. Basic theorem by Miller says that if the theory of your structure with the two functions, lambda and sigma, admits quantifier elimination to the relative to the theory of just your base structure, then adding the set E gives you a d-minimal structure. Okay, and to get this quantifier elimination result, we like using an embedding test. Try seeing where you start with the base model, you have an elementary extension, a proper elementary extension, and a saturated elementary extension. This is B plus saturated. And you have to come up with an intermediate model here, which is going to be a proper extension of A that's contained in B, and we want to embed it into the saturated model. Pretty standard quantifier elimination test. I should mention, because I'm going to use the A, this is A, B, so mu is going to be the extended lambda, prime through the saturated model. Now, specifically, I said the one set was nice because it was the iterates of something of the squared function. It was the iterates of a defined function. So we're going to look at, we're going to actually assume, look at the case where your set E is given by iterates of some definable function. So specifically, you take a zero definable function such that the successor of everything in the set, of anything in the set, is f of that. Take lambda of anything, it's anything in the set. So lambda of anything, successor of anything in the set is f of that, except possibly at zero, it's a default case we're not really worried about. The things that make the embedding test work, you need two assumptions. One is that if you start with m, and you apply f finitely many times, that spans the finite elements of your structure. And for an infinite element, if you iterate f and the inverse, you get the t level. It's in some sense, you need this to make the embedding test work. One reason this whole setup will not work for Z, for adding the natural numbers, is that the successor function for the natural numbers would be x plus 1. And x plus 1 will not, adding 1 will tend to span the finite set of, the finite elements of your field, but it's not gonna span the T levels. It said if you have a field, you're at least going to need to take the powers of x to span the field. Okay, so some other results we can get from this. These are statements you can easily get by just looking at the setup. They figure into the calculation. But two important consequences of this is, if x is positive infinite, then lambda of x is in the t level of x, which kind of expect, because if f takes something in E to something else in E, they're both going to be in the same t level. So if x is between them, you're going to be in the same t level. Next thing is our convex sets. The other very key thing is that if x is positive infinite, then f of x is also in the set. If you take any element in the set that's positive infinite, f of it is in the set again, and the inverses of f are in the set again. Which means that when we generate the structure, if you throw in one element of the set, E, then the definable closure gives you a span of the T level within the set. So that's a basic setup. What I want to mention is What are some more consequences of the local inequality that we're going to use? I like to express this by saying, talking about T-constrained. A T-constrained set is one where, if you take its definable closure, you don't find any new T-levels. Or say more precisely, if you take anything in the definable closure, there's something in the original set that's in the T-level of your thing in the definable closure. Or X is in the T... This is an equivalence relation, so it's equivalent to X is in the T-level of A. Often use this to define the closed set as T-constrained. Because we're going to add a new element. So what's going to make this... The part of the local inequality you're going to use in this case is just not worry about the small stuff, but just worry about the big stuff. In the big case, it says that if you start with something that's actually just T-constrained or definably closed, and you add a new element, if that new element witnesses a new T-level, it's the only new T-level you get. You can't get a second T-level out of it. Since we're just using this, this shows you that there's probably something more you can do, because this isn't saying anything about the small stuff. There's some potential for if you add something that represents a new small equivalence class, a monad, as they call them, then you don't get a new T-level. And this isn't actually used in this test, so we can probably push this result a little bit more if we want to use that part of the Wilkie inequality. The key set here is, if you take a definably closed set, you add a new T-level represented by an element, you only get one new T-level. Okay, so if we look at this in the embedding test, BZK... Okay, so we write this up nicely. The embedding test, the problem is when you make, when your bigger model, your B, that you're trying to embed into the B prime, when that actually has a bigger set E, a bigger discrete set. If the discrete set hasn't grown any, then basically everything you can extend by any set, any element, O-minimality gives you an embedding into the saturated model. So there's no problem finding an embedding. There's no problem generating a substructure from a single element. The two problems you're faced with is showing that if you do this in the O-minimal setting, first of all, you need this to be a model in the bigger setting, where your predecessor function is actually, the image of the predecessor function is actually contained in the structure generated by O-minimality. And the way you do that is I'll get to that. And the other thing to make sure is that the embedding actually commutes with this predecessor function. Now the easy case is if the image of lambda, if your discrete set hasn't grown any, then you just pick anything you want. Just following a few calculations, the type of any element in an O-minimal structure is determined by its cut, where it is in the order of the set, order in the underlying set of structure, and that's enough to tell you what the predecessor is. And it's going to be, of course, this case, this is going to be easily satisfied because C is going to contain A and mu of C is going to be contained in A. This quick calculation shows that in your new structure, if anything already has an image, has a predecessor in A, then that won't cause any problems in the embedding. The problem is to show what is to con- oh, yes. The problem is what happens if you've made your set bigger. What happens if your new set, your extension of E, is strictly bigger than what you started with? So somehow it's got to deal with this new thing. So we just choose. We choose an X which is going to be in the new set. And it's not going to be in the old. Choose an X that's in the new set, not in the old set. Just by virtue of that, you know two things about it. One is, since we know M is in A, we know M is in the base set, F of M is in the base set, we know that all the finite elements of E are in the base set. So if you choose something new, it has to be infinite. Positive infinite. The other thing we know is that since it's positive infinite, if you iterate F up and down, you're going to span the T level. You're going to get all the elements of E that are in the T level. And none of them are going to be in A, which tells you that you actually are adding something with a new T level. Now this is where you can see the Wilk inequality can come into play that says, because we're expanding a structure defined a closed set by a new element which witnesses a new T level. So we take the definable closure of A and X, we make that be your intermediate model C. You know that you only have one new T level. This is your A union X is T constrained. So then you just be a little careful in choosing the embedding from the minimal point of view that you want the embedding to send X to something that's in the set in the saturated model. It's not a problem. But once you do that, everything's going to be fixed. And this is going to show we have this part, some calculations that show that if you're in the T level of X, when you embed X to something that's going to be in the set in the saturated model, you're also taking all the iterates of F to things in the set. So F of X, so look at the X is in the set, phi is the embedding, phi of X will be in the set in the saturated model, but then also F of X is in E, and phi of F of X is in E prime. And this is also F and phi commute, because F is part of the O-minimal structure, is defined in it. So we've got a bunch of elements of E that span the T level of X mapping into elements of E which span the T level of phi of X. And then the same thing we did for the other case shows that everything in the T level of X is going to map into something, and it's going to map to the saturated model in such a way that phi and mu commute. We also want to say is that what the Wilk inequality is telling us is that that's all we have to worry about. There's no other T levels to worry about. If you're not in the T level of X, then you're in the T level of something that was already in A. And from what we meant from that other calculation, you know that the phi of the mu of that element is already in A. It's not new. The point is, all the new elements are in this T level of X. This makes it convenient. This embodies all the new elements. So with these two cases, with the two cases here, you check all the calculations there, we have an embedding test, which tells us that under those assumptions that F is definable in your O-minimal structure, its iterates span the T-levels, that you can add the set, you can add E, which is essentially you can add the set, which is, if Oops, I meant F. You take F of E, you get E again, without the M. You can add this to your O-minimal structure, and the result will be D-minimal. Okay. So, these examples I put up earlier, we have R to the 2 to the N. R to the R, and you add on 2 to the 2 to the N. So, for this case, F of X is X squared. X squared takes you from one element of this set to the next element. So we conclude that so that whole argument will show you that this is D-minimal. On the other hand, considering the corollary, we know if you add the set N times 2 to the 2 to the N, that will not be D-minimal. Because we can take, did I put this here? It's not D-minimal. Let me put the calculation on here. There's this nice little calculation here. You take an element of the set, you take F of it, you divide by X squared, and this other function, if you follow through all the algebra, it turns out that from this set, we can define the natural numbers, not zero, all the other natural numbers. And from natural numbers, we get the rational number. For natural numbers, we get the rational numbers. So what does this tell us about this function? Well, if we started out with the structure of the field with this function, if we had a function which would map n times 2 to the 2 to the n to n plus 1 times 2 to the 2 to the n plus 1. If we had a function that would fit that set, if we add it to the base field, we can't have an O-minimal structure. Because that's the only hypothesis of this theorem that it could be violated. So in a sense, this is one result of all this is you can find new ways. You can prove that certain functions cannot live in an, well, joined with the field, the resulting structure cannot be O-minimal. Why exactly it's not O-minimal, I'm not sure, but I guess, I'm not really sure, I haven't seen what such a function would look like, but it just tells you this function is not going to give you an O-minimal structure. What set can you define that violates O-minimality? In some sense, it looks like a nice function. It's almost X squared, but there's something a little odd with it. Okay, so there's some things we can show by using this very coarse version of the Loci inequality. Now, I said that also there's some possibility that going through all this, we only use the fact that if you add a new t-level, you only add one new t-level. Never bothered with anything like adding something small doesn't add a new t-level. Now, what should be the... We haven't checked all this out. But what should be the... corresponding theorem to use a full Loci inequality is that you don't necessarily need this function to be definable. You just need this function to occupy, you call it an irrational cut in the Hardy field. You need a function such that for every definable function it's either ultimately bigger or ultimately smaller and not equal. Well, that'll be the cut, and also one other thing, you also need another function in between. So if you have F, and you have your definable G, not just being bigger, there's also a definable G naught that lies between G and F. like an irrational number. For any rational number, there's a rational number between the rational and the irrational. So we call this irrational set. For any function, there's another. For any definable function, say there's another definable function between G and F. We call that an irrational cut. Well, since this is this other definable function plays this role of another definable element. Remember, the small elements for my version of Wilkie inequality was the intersection of these intervals where C1 less than X less than C2. Okay, write this all out, 1 at X. And they're in the definable closure of X. So, it's a very simplified version of this. So if you take... So in this setup, this F should be occupying... should somehow represent a new monad. For any different... If you have something definable outside it, there's something else definable and smaller. So somehow this F would represent a new monad, which means if you throw in images of F, if you have a structure, if you have your A, and you add to an element in the F of X, this should be occupying a new monad relative to A and X. Which means if you add it to your structure, you're not going to get a new T-level. Now, how does this help in the embedding test? The complication in the embedding test for this case is before when we did the embedding test, we could just add X to it. We added X, and because F of X was in the definable closure of A and X, we already got all the iterates of E within the set, within the T level, all the elements of E that would be within that T level. If F is not definable, we don't get them. We'd have to add them explicitly. We'd have to add we have to add countably many of these. 6, 0, x1. In order to make sure that you have all the elements of E that are in this new T level represented by X, you'd have to add countably many elements of E. And you can do this because since F is not definable, none of these elements are going to be in your definable closure. So you just add them all in. They're going to be definably independent. We can certainly map them into the saturated model and keep them being in the E in the saturated model. The problem that's going to come up is, how do you know that you haven't introduced a new T level? Because the T level is going to get... Because once you map all these things to the saturated model, the whole definable closure gets mapped. It's all determined. So this is where you'd have to rely on the more general Wilkie inequality that says, if you just show that all these occupy a new monad in the structure, then you only add the new T level. If you add x0, you add a new t-level. But when you add all these other elements, there's no new t-levels appearing, so there's no new elements of E to worry about. In that sense, the whole argument should go through. Okay. Okay. Let's see what else I was going to say. This is what we have so far from the from this general Wilkie inequality. It says, if you add something really, you have the monads and you have the T-levels, and you can add one or the other. Now ideally, I have another one. Now if you compare this Wilkie inequality, if you look in the case of fields, what we have is there's a residue map. If you take a field, it maps to if you have a big field, if a proper subfield, the subfield tells you what infinitesimal gives you a maximal ideal. It's actually a maximal ideal of the ring, of the convex ring of that field. If you can take it's actually V. Yeah, I read that wrong. So you have a residue map that maps R to R modulo this maximal ideal of this new field, of the convex ring this field, and this is actually going to be equivalent to R prime, or isomorphic R prime. This is a residue field, and if you define monads, monads correspond to things in the same residue class. The Wilkie inequality in the power bounded case says that if you extend a field, if you extend your big field, you're going to extend. Which way? I'm doing this the wrong way. It's that way. Okay. You can extend the residue field. Let's put them in the same order. And you can extend, in the polynomial bounded case, you have the valuation field, valuation group. So it's the Q dimension. Right. Okay, so the Wilkie inequality for the fields says that the rank of your big structure is bigger than or equal to the rank of this residue field, which corresponds to the monads. In that sense, this Wilkie inequality is the same. It still deals with these monads. But the big piece they were looking at was the Q dimension of the value group. Well, K dimension. The field of excellence is Q. It's the Q dimension of the value group. The value group is a lot smaller than the T level. Because you have, if you take any element of the value group, then you have two gamma. Two gamma is going to be in the same. Give you the same dimension, but if you have to take something odd, like the square root of 2 times gamma, which we can define from the clear ways to define that from the field if you look at a big enough thing. Adding an element of x such that the valuation of x equals that This is going to increase the Q level, the Q dimension of the value group, but doesn't add a new T level. Now, so this is where this Wilkie inequalities fall short, is that it can't find these smaller things. The vision I've heard for ideal Wilkie inequality would actually, in this case, would reduce to this thing, where instead of just T levels, you're looking at some sort of dimension, or some sort of rank of some structure that it can go up even if the T level doesn't. That's basically what I want to say about that stuff. So, I guess.